This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The drive-in theater. Whether you were a little kid jumping into your PJs before mom and dad packed up the station wagon and took the family out, or a teenager looking for a little privacy on a date, the drive-in theater could be a pretty magical place. The very first drive-in opened in New Jersey in 1933, but it sure didn't take long for Michiganders to catch on to the drive-in. They opened up in virtually every corner of the state. My next guest channeled his happy boyhood memories of going to the drive-in to come up with a book for the Images of America series. It's called Michigan's Drive-In Theaters. Harry Skirdla, good to have you with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
What's your early memories of going to the drive-in?
It was the early 60s, and my mother was a housewife, and what do you do when you want to entertain the kids? So she would pack us up, often in our pajamas, into the big green station wagon and take us to the drive-in.
I didn't even know when I wrote that introduction. I didn't know that's exactly how you experienced it. I know we did because you'd hop up on the roof and watch on the roof. I know you're an engineer. You're an historic preservation consultant. What propelled you to take this deep dive and write this book, tracking the history of Michigan's drive-ins?
Well, beginning in the late 70s, the writing was on the wall that they probably weren't going to be around forever. I think maybe one or two had been torn down. So I collared a friend of mine who was a photographer, and we went around on his motorcycle to operating drive-ins at dusk and took photos of them. That was the late 70s, and there was a sort of a vast purge of drive-ins around 84 and 85.
Why was that?
I don't think that this was something that was a conspiracy against them.
Like a concerted movement.
Right. It wasn't the anti-drive-in forces run amok. It was that a number of things were just conspiring against them right at that time. And a lot of them were torn down simultaneously because a number of them were owned by the same chains.
What were some of the things conspiring against them?
Well, when Hollingshead opened his first drive-in.
And who is that?
Richard Hollingshead. He was a sort of entrepreneur in Camden, New Jersey. His father and grandfather operated a successful company that manufactured auto products. But it was the Depression, and he had an income, and he worked for the company. But he was thinking about what would be a Depression-proof business. And as he thought about it, he made a little list. And he decided that the last things that people would give up would be their cars and going to the movies. He did some research, and he talked to people at RCA to see if it was possible to put speakers up at a screen and have people listen to them from, you know, without being deafened in the front row, if you could hear it in the back. I talked to his son years ago, and his son distinctly remembered his father setting up a screen between two trees in their driveway and setting a 16-millimeter projector on the hood of the car and sitting in their car to see if you could watch a movie that way.
So early test marketing was done on the family.
Yes, it was his family that were the guinea pigs.
But he made it happen, and he opens this one, in the first one in 1933. How long did it take for the drive-in to make its way to Michigan?
Well, it sort of gradually snowballed. He had a patent on it. Theoretically, people had to pay to his license. But that never worked out very well, and he was constantly suing people. And as it turned out, the second drive-in ever built on the planet wasn't one that he knew anything about. It was a guy who went to his theater and said, well, I could do that, and went back to Orfield, Pennsylvania, where he was from, and built his own drive-in.
Which I think you note is still open?
Schenkweiler's Drive-In, yes. It's still open.
So that one survived.
And one of the problems that Hollingshead had with his first drive-in, and one of the reasons it only lasted a few years before he sold it, was it was very loud because it only had central speakers next to the screen, and there were neighbors. His son told me there was also a problem with, imagine you're watching a Western and somebody shoots the bad guy. Well, he would be on the ground before the people in the back rows heard the gunshot.
A little delay there.
And then the people in the houses heard the gunshots, and they didn't like that much either.
But ultimately, the sound problems got ironed out.
Well,
they fixed the little speakers. Hanging on the window.
In the book, there's a picture of an intermediate step. They tried intermediate things, a sort of buried in the ground under the car where they thought it would speak up through the floorboards. Oh, that was a good idea. And there was another version that had clusters of speakers about every four cars or something like that. Schenkweiler's fixed the problem, though, early on. They still had the speakers by the screen, but they piped the sound back to the neighbors' porches. So the neighbors who could see the screen could just sit on their porch and listen to their own speaker for free.
Kind of like people living around Wrigley Field in
yes,
Chicago.
Yes, exactly.
I'm talking with Harry Skirdla, who is a historic preservation consultant and an engineer. And his book for the Images of America series is Michigan's Drive-In Theaters, really tracking the fascinating design and history of the drive-ins that really ultimately made their way all over Michigan. I'm wondering, did you see regional differences in the design or size or amenities of drive-in theaters in Michigan?
Regional within the country, but not so much within the state. It was more, there were a finite number of architects. There are pictures in the book of the Dearborn and the Beltline and some others. Well, if you look at them, or at the time that I took the pictures, you're driving along and you see this drive-in and go, wait a minute, that looks just like, yeah, there were a lot of them where I think the architect just said, yeah, sure.
Stamp them out.
That's right. I mean, it's one set of blueprints. I'll accept commissions for this.
It was really an experience that was more than the movie, wasn't it? The amenities were so much a part of it.
Those old enough to remember going to them or those still fortunate enough to live near them. The picture was never the best. I mean, you could have gone to a good indoor theater and had a brighter picture. And if you're sitting in your car, there's always a question of whether it'll rain or bugs or, of course, the days of the in-car speaker are pretty much past. There may still be a few. The Capri Drive-In out at Coldwater, in addition to radio sound, they kept some in the back, but then later they added a second screen, and when they did that, they just gave up. Frankly, I'm as nostalgic as the next person, but those speakers were never very good. And if you're listening on your car radio, you can actually listen in decent stereo, where that wasn't an option. Although they did make, back in the 50s, supposed stereo in-car speakers that had two or even three speakers in a cluster, and yet it still hooked on the window.
Huh.
So to hear decent stereo effect, you'd kind of have to face the window, which didn't seem like a good idea.
Not when the screen was straight ahead. And, of course, there were the playgrounds and the merry-go-rounds and the big, big concession stands, because those of us who went remember the parade of dancing popcorn boxes.
And if you go to one now, you are more likely than not to still see that. I'm not quite sure where they get them now. The last time I went to the Capri, they still had the, you know, the talking hot dog and everything in between. And the print was not bad. So I don't, of course, the Capri has converted to digital, so it may be a digital file. But I was amazed because the concession stands are still essentially unchanged and the concession food is essentially unchanged in a good way. Some drive-ins, once upon a time, were kind of bad about, well, we didn't sell the hot dog. Throw it back in the refrigerator. We'll try again tomorrow.
It was a different era in food safety standards. When you think about some, imagine offering pony rides and merry-go-rounds, depends on how deep the owner's wallet was.
Well, right. It was amazingly common, especially when a drive-in opened. Pony rides were always a big thing because you can lure people in. And some of them kept the
pony rides.
The
kids were watching
the
Westerns. We were watching, Davy Crockett and...
The other things, though, amazingly expensive sort of kiddie amusement park rides, miniature railroads, circular boat ride with actual water in it, and even the smallest had teeter-totters and swings and things like that. It spread also into other amenities. Some of the earlier ones, when it was more of a novelty and they could afford the huge staff, the Gratiot, for example, they had people who roamed around the lot washing your windows for free.
You mentioned diaper services for young
diaper
moms.
Diaper services, bottle warmers. It had developed into a huge, elaborate thing by the time the drive-ins reached their peak in about 58.
And how many did we have in Michigan when they were at their peak?
Well, there aren't any reliable figures. There are lots of figures, but they don't all agree with each other.
What do you believe?
About 130 at a time, about 160 total.
So from that 140 to 160 or so high, how many do we have today?
Today we have, at this very minute, as far as I know, there are eight. The first drive-in in Michigan opened in 38, and it was the 10th in the country or in the world. That was the one that became eventually known as the East Side in Detroit. The second one in the state was the one that became known as the West Side. which was up on 8 Mile. All of the drive-ins were originally called drive-in theater. And once you had more than one drive-in theater, you kind of had to start calling them something.
Ours was the Miracle Mile. Telegraph Square Lake, we're probably about where Costco is sitting right
and
now.
And that Miracle Mile was one of the most deluxe drive-ins because it was a fairly late one, and they got better and better at it as they went. Most of them were built just after the war, probably between, say, 47 and 50. As I said, it peaked in 58. And at that point, there were probably 3,700 in the country. What killed them essentially was they were constructed of necessity on the outskirts of towns where the property was cheap on roads and hopefully intersections of roads that were main thoroughfares so the traffic could get there, but that they could afford the acres of land that they required. Well, these cities kept on growing over the years. And in the case of the Gratiot, ironically, the same architect, the architectural firm that designed the Gratiot in 48, was designing the strip mall that replaced it in 85. Well, I went and talked to them at the time, and the senior architect said the drive-in was still making money, but they gave them $10 million for the property. No drive-in is going to make $10 million.
It is a fascinating study as to how there was a moment in time and then time moved on. The book is at Michigan's Drive-In Theaters for the Images of America series. Harry Skirdla, who is an historic preservation consultant, so his heart is certainly in the place, and also the kid who was in the pajamas in the station wagon enjoying the drive-in. Harry, it was good to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.